Germain over about a year ago, and it recently got finished. So I thought I'd talk about this. Some of you may have heard a brief version of this in a different meeting. So let me start off telling you what the motivation is. The central feature of what has been happening in loop quantum cosmology in the last several years has focused largely on effects of something called the inverse scale factor operator. And it plays a central role in just about any result that's come out of loop quantum cosmology in some way. So what we decided to do is ask what this sort of operator looks like in a familiar context and see how it actually resolves singularities in quantum gravity. So here's a brief outline. First, I'll tell you what it is that people try to look for in singularity avoidance in quantum gravity, what the term means. And then I'll summarize some of the things that have been going on in quantum gravity concerning singularity avoidance in the last few years. There's lots of people working on this. Then I'll talk about how this whole thing can be transplanted into a quantum mechanics type of problem and ask exactly how singularities are being resolved in that quantum mechanical setting. And then I'll go in and talk about its implications for Wheeler-DeWitt equations on lattices, and then summarize what we've learned from this exercise. So firstly, the basic observation is that whenever you have a classically singular potential, I'm thinking of quantum mechanics now, singularity avoidance, for example, in the Coulomb problem in the hydrogen atom or any other atom, consists of sort of two things. The first thing is what one might call kinematical singularity avoidance. This amounts to looking at basis states in your Hilbert space and computing the expectation value of potentials and asking, are these expectation values bounded? Then the other aspect is dynamical singularity avoidance. Usually in quantum mechanics, one doesn't make the distinction, but here it's probably worth making a distinction because of the approach to quantum gravity. Certain constraints are easier to quantize than others, so the separation has been made into kinematical and dynamical. So the dynamical singularity avoidance one might compare with scattering from a potential. So if you have a Coulomb potential, you do Coulomb scattering. If you have a square well, you just do some sort of scattering and see whether, if your singular was potential, if your potential was singular, whether there's any effect of the singularity in scattering. And so another way to think about both these things together is we're really looking for a unitary quantum theory in which what was singular classically is no longer singular in these two aspects.
So it's a harmonic oscillator potential singular by the first definition because it blows up from large x?
So usually this refers to boundedness below. So the Coulomb potential is when r goes to zero, there's this minus infinity. It's not really referred to the other
end.
So
it's okay if potential diverges at infinity?
If it diverges at infinity, the only requirement is that your wave functions have appropriate fall off, and that's the only issue there. Yeah. So I'm really thinking of divergences that lead to energies not being bounded below. Yeah. Okay. What happened? Okay. So similarly, in quantum gravity, what we would like is whatever quantization you have, you want curvature operators to have the same kind of property that you have for potentials. And the dynamical part would be scattering from what classically would be infinite curvature regions, or whatever you might want to call it, evolution through the singularity is something that's often used. But whatever you mean by scattering, you can sort of set it up and say, okay, here's a classically singular region, and throw a wave packet at it, see what comes out, and see if one can detect any sort of singularity there. Okay, wrong one. So recent developments have largely, yes?
The paradigm is in the hydrogen atom,
right.
It is singular in the first sense, but not singular in the second sense. You're saying you're hoping for something more?
Singular in the first sense, meaning?
That the potential blows up.
The expectation value of the potential doesn't blow up in the quantum theory.
Well, what if you chose an appropriate state?
Oh, no, I'm thinking of eigenstates. Yeah, I'm thinking of eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. And in eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, there is the energy is bounded below. So it's not all states.
So you mean, you're really saying the Hamiltonian should be bounded below?
So in the quantum mechanical calculation, I'm thinking of the Hamiltonian energy being bounded below. Yes. And we need to transplant that sort of intuition into the quantum gravity regime. And I'm trying to ask, what is the appropriate thing? We could do it with the Hamiltonian, but for curvature singularity avoidance, one would like to think about curvature is not blowing up anymore.
Well, but then, this may be just terminological, yeah. But then I'm confused by calling it kinematical.
I'm trying to separate the time-independent Schrodinger equation from the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And the reason I'm making that separation, perhaps I should have been clearer, is that this is an issue in quantum gravity because there is no time. And so one starts off with a kinematical Hilbert space and then one tries to do some sort of dynamics in some way. So the first statement is at the level of a time-independent Schrodinger equation.
But even the time-independent Schrodinger
equation has
dynamics.
It does, it does.
Even that would be the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yes, but it has dynamics in a certain sense, but it's the closest analogy one can make with the quantum gravity situation, where one has, I'm sort of getting into what I'm going to say later, but where one separates kinematical constraints, which are the spatial diffeomorphisms, from the Hamiltonian constraint. So in the case when one is dealing just with the kinematical constraints, that is the time-independent situation. And so I'm comparing the time-independent situation with the time-independent Schrodinger equation here. I mean, I have to make some sort of an analogy for the comparison.
I would have made a different analogy. Okay,
well, yeah. So I think essentially the separation I'm thinking of is motivated by quantum gravity, which is much more clear in quantum gravity than it is in quantum mechanics, where there is an external time. Okay. Oops. Okay, so the developments in FRW cosmology sort of have several components, which I'll list here. The first one I already mentioned is this inverse scale factor operator, and I'll talk about this a bit later. This is a central ingredient. The second is a set of calculations where one actually does scattering. So the first part is kinematical, the scattering part is dynamical because one has some notion of time. And then one sort of sends a wave packet at this 1 over a, which is viewed as a potential in an exact analogy, but it's an approximate analogy with this type of separation I had before between kinematics and dynamics. And so these are the results in loop quantum cosmology. There are qualitatively similar results in metric variables, and so one of the things that appear to be the case here is that these results are due to fundamental discreteness and not due to the particular choice of variables that are being used. So there could be other ways of quantizing with a fundamental discreteness where similar things happen. The other aspect of these developments have been so-called effective dynamics, and what happens here is you start off with some classical mini superspace model where you just have a Hamiltonian constraint. Then you convert it into an operator with some quantization. Then the main thing is the second step, which is in the Hamiltonian constraint, you see inverse powers of square root of q. And what you want to do is convert them into an operator. And in loop quantum gravity, the standard trick for this has been the so-called Feynman trick, which I'll briefly describe later. The next thing is you want to compute something called an effective Hamiltonian constraint. This is one of the ways people have proceeded. And here what one does is one takes a kinematical state. By kinematical state, I mean a state which is not a solution to the Hamiltonian constraint, but is possibly a solution to any other constraints you have, like the spatial diffeomorphism constraint or the Gauss law constraint. If you're not in the mini superspace sector, if you're in the mini superspace sector, then whatever your kinematical Hilbert space is, you pick some sort of kinematical state there, which is dependent on external parameters pq, perhaps a sort of Gaussian state peaked at a phase space point PQ. And then you compute the expectation value of H and call that an effective Hamiltonian. And then you use that effective Hamiltonian as if it was a genuine Hamiltonian and just write, do Friedman dynamics using the Hamilton's equations using that. So this H effective has the effects of this 1 over A type of operator built into it. And as I said, that's the central feature that goes into any of these considerations. And so this is the reason I want to focus on it to see what happens.
Is this in some gauge-fixed form?
No, this is here. These effective dynamics is not in any gauge-fixed form because one is saying we've got a Hamiltonian constraint, and all we want to do is we want to take this Hamiltonian constraint to define an effective quantum-corrected Hamiltonian constraint. And so when this goes, this is not a Hamiltonian. This is still a Hamiltonian constraint. And so all you do is you say, I've got a Hamiltonian constraint operator. I'm going to compute its expectation value in some sort of coherent state, this peak dot some phase space point PQ. And I get a classical function of those parameters P and Q. And then I just use the classical function as if it was a real Hamiltonian constraint coming from some classical theory, compute Hamilton's equations, and those give me modified Friedman dynamics. So instead of H, we're just using expectation value of H, and it's got some corrections built in because of this 1 over A. You might want to think of this, the analogy here would be something like...
you go to a constraint submanifold, you have to work on the zero of this function?
I mean, no, not in this approach. So this is here, you get another constraint system, but with a different Hamiltonian constraint, because the new Hamiltonian constraint is derived by taking an expectation value of some operator.
It's a specifically Euclidean approach.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the comparison would be something like.
If you have a Hamiltonian, you have to go on the zero submanifold where on the zero that would be physical.
Yeah. So if you the other approach
is there an analog of that?
You mean solving the constraint
yeah,
and going
yeah.
to the constraint surface? No. There's no analog of this. No. So that's another approach. That approach would say, right, we're going to fix a time gauge, we're going to get a true Hamiltonian, which depends on true physical variables because all the constraints have been solved, and you have a true Hamiltonian. Then you do dynamics with a true Hamiltonian. That's a different approach.
Yeah, that's a different approach.
Yeah. And I don't know if there's no direct connection here, because here, this is just another constraint system, so we could do time gauge fixing and all the rest of it here, too, if you want to. Okay. So the only analogy I have with this is this comparison in unconstrained systems with the Ehrenfest kind of relations where you simply say, okay, but what do I do there? I want to ask how are classical equations of motion recovered from a quantum, from Heisenberg equations, and I take expectation values in some states, and I get state-dependent evolution equations. So this is the same kind of...
I'm still confused on this slide, but maybe we should...
Okay. So anyway, the central point for what I'm going to say is everything on this transparency and the one before focused on this 1 over A and its role in giving you quantum gravity corrections. I keep pressing the wrong button. So before going on to that, I just want to point out some build-up to the essential ingredient leading to these so-called corrections. The first is that in LQG, the basic operators are a shift operator, which is a holonomy, and a diagonal operator, which is a triad operator. That's sort of the general picture. The second comment is that these are just like a field and its translation operators on a lattice, for example, lattice QCD. And then the third point is that shift operators are essentially the central ingredient in defining inverse scale factor or other curvature operators. So any sort of discreteness will lead you, if you want to do some sort of quantization, to shift operators. And the shift operators, whatever their nature, whatever the variables you're using, are directly responsible for defining these inverse operators. And that's the thing we want to understand a bit more. So the first example I just want to look at is what happens for just a particle. And this is something which is also been developed by people working in loop quantum gravity. It's a so-called polymer, or another term for it is Bohr quantization. So the basic idea is really simple. You say that your Hilbert space is function psi of p, which are finite linear combinations of exponentials of that type. Up there, you know, the mu k are any real numbers. So you can think of the mu k, we're thinking of quantum mechanics on a line. So mu k are just 10 real numbers that you happen to give me. I'll write down those functions. So all n. The inner product is given in the middle line. And on these functions, one can represent an x operator and a translation operator as below. So x is diagonal, and u is just a translation operator. So in this representation, operators corresponding to the momentum do not exist. Okay? Just the translation exists. The momentum operator doesn't exist because essentially mu k's are just a discrete set of numbers.
Is this just like a wavelet?
I think there's a relationship to wavelets. Yes, yes. Yes.
To wavelets.
To wavelets. So this is basically the simplest possible thing you can cook up with a shift operator. Now, if you want to do quantum mechanics with this, since you don't have a p, you want to define a Hamiltonian, you have to use these translation operators to do that. So one way to write p squared using just the u's you have available is up there. And the action of p squared on a basis state in uk, a basis state, of course, is just one of these elements, one of these exponentials, e to the I mu kp. Oops. That's the action. And if you have a potential, and this is where I want to illustrate the Feynman trick. If you have a potential 1 over x, of course the Coulomb potential is 1, not 1 over magnitude of x, but we just want to think of 1 over magnitude of x potential on the real line for purposes of illustration. One has this Poisson bracket relation between the translation operator u and the square root of magnitude of x. It doesn't need to be a square root. It can be any fractional power such that you get an inverse power on the right-hand side. I'm just using the power half here. So one can indirectly write 1 over x like this, using this Poisson bracket of u and x as the fundamental one. And if one now just put hats on these things and converts it into an operator, one finds that the spectrum of 1 over x looks like this. Now, again, although this is done in this context, similar relations can be easily be written down on any lattice quantization where you have a shift operator, and some people have looked at that, including Oliver and myself, Arundhati, and I think others too. So this is what the picture looks like. What I have here is the Coulomb potential, and this is the eigenvalue of the 1 over x operator. So you see that it's bounded, and it's not differentiable at one point, and that's evident already from these magnitudes inside the square roots. That's not going to be differentiable. So it's a different potential. And so we want to ask, well, what does the spectrum look like of the Hamiltonian with that piece, with that kinetic term and the potential term written in this way? Yes? Oh, yes, yes, yes. I didn't put the parameter here. So here, it depends on lambda. Oops, going the wrong way. And for this graph, lambda is 0.01. I'm just about to write it down. So as you vary lambda, this little peak here, you can see this little peak there just moves around. Mm-hmm. And if lambda is small, it's very close to the origin. If lambda is large, it's far from the origin. OK, so what we did to see what the effect on the spectrum would be is to solve this so-called polymer eigenvalue problem. We look for energy eigenstates, which are just linear combinations of basis states. And we want to find these coefficients ck such that with certain boundary conditions at the origin, we get some spectra for the Hamiltonian. So what we wanted to look at is, of course, they have to be normalizable. And we initially looked for anti-symmetric wave functions, so that we want ck to equal minus c of minus k. So classically, we know, for the continuum, we know what the energy eigenvalues are. They're just minus 1 over 4 n squared with the normalizations that I've used here. And that's just the usual thing. So, of course, here we get a difference equation because of the form of the kinetic energy and the potential energy. And the difference equation is the thing we want to solve. And so this is our method. If you plug in this linear combination at the top there into the eigenvalue problem, the top line gives you the recursion relation between the coefficients. And that function fn in there is essentially coming from the regularization of this 1 over x potential using this trick, the Feynman trick. So what we want to do is, the first thing we notice is that for e less than 0 and large n, there's an exact solution for this recursion relation. And that's the formula for it there. So what we want to do is we want to start off with some large n and a negative e such that we can ignore the lambda fn term in there and see if we can, for that case, we have the exact solution. Now we use a numerical shooting method for finding all the other C's and focusing in on the ground state. This is a standard method, but I'll just summarize in two lines how it works. So what we do is pick an E, which is any E at this stage, but less than 0. And we pick some large N, call it N0. And what we do is we compute C of N0 using that formula. Then we use a recursion relation to recurse down to C0 using the recursion relation at the top. And then we repeat this procedure until we get C0 as a function of E. In other words, we start off again with a different E, compute a C0, start off with another E, compute a C0. That's the essence of the shooting method. So here are the results. I'll just tell you, what I'm going to show you are plots of this function C0E as a function for fixed lambda at the moment, because all these things depend on lambda. So this is, I'm now plotting it C0 not as a function of E, but as a function of this parameter K, which you can calculate from E. And so what we want to look for is we're looking for the anti-symmetric solution, so we're looking for C0 equals 0. And so we want roots of that function. So as a function of C0, C0 as a function of K, for this range of k, we get this graph for lambda equals 0.01. You can see that it has got zeros exactly at k equals 1 and k equals 2. So it looks like we're hitting the usual spectrum bang on for lambda equals 0. So essentially, the point is that from this end, let me just show you the next one as well. This is the same thing for a different range of k. Here, what you see is that the zeros for this range of k which is, again, related to E, now gives roots at 2 and 3. And you can keep doing this. And you see that the roots of this function C0 of E always occur at the integers. What that means is that we're hitting the eigenvalues dead on. Yes?
Why was C0 supposed to
vanish? Oh, because I'm imposing a condition on the wave function that the wave function be anti-symmetric.
Oh.
And C0 is the coefficient of I'm going to talk about the symmetric one in a bit later.
Can you just read, is this equivalent to just doing a sort of finite difference discretization?
I'm coming to that as well. So it would be, let me just answer it briefly now. It would be if we were not using the Feynman trick, because that's not a standard finite difference kind of an approximation. But one of the things I'm going to point out, I'll just say it now, is that the Feynman trick, in fact, exactly boils down to a new kind of a finite difference discretization for, I'll show you what it is later on. And then it's related to the main point I want to make. Okay, so these are C0 as a function of E, and then we want to ask how these eigenvalues behave as a function of lambda, and you can see that here's lambda from 0.3 to about 0.001. And you can see it converges to minus a quarter as lambda goes to 0. And the same for the next excited state, it converges to 0.0625 as lambda goes to 0. OK, so now let me come to finite difference approximation. So these are the results we get. The symmetric ones, I'll just mention, I didn't put them on as a graph. What happens with the symmetric boundary conditions are that these energies are very strongly dependent on lambda. And they, the ground state actually diverges as lambda goes to zero for the symmetric case. For the anti-symmetric case, it doesn't. It converges to a fixed value. And the strong dependence is
the ground state energy.
The ground state energy diverges for the symmetric case to minus infinity. And so even if the singularity is regulated, it seems to have no effect on the spectrum, because the spectrum depends on lambda. Whereas in these cases, for the anti-symmetric case, it doesn't. Okay, so now let me just come to finite difference approximations. And so normally, if you just want to take a Schrodinger equation and put it on a lattice, and you don't know anything about quantum gravity, and you don't know anything about polymer quantization, and you just don't know how to solve a Schrodinger equation analytically, this is what you would do. You'd say, well, I've got a second derivative. I'll write it like this. Now, what would you do for the potential energy? Well, one thing you could do is you can say, well, I want to write 1 over x in a regulated way. So you can say, well, 1 over x is nothing but the derivative of root x with some factor. And so what I want to do is just finite difference that derivative of root x. So if you finite difference the derivative of the root x, there are lots of different ways to do it. One way of doing it will give you this formula. And that formula turns out to be identical to the Feynman trick. The other finite difference schemes for the derivative, more accurate, higher order accurate schemes in lambda, and they will give you a different sort of Feynman tricks. But ultimately, the Feynman trick is just a finite differencing of a derivative from this point of view. And so all the results that follow in LQC are exactly this too. And so the bottom line is that it's all identical to polymer quantization. So coming to Wheeler de Witt equations, I just want to emphasize the point I was making earlier about what happens when you...
Before you go on,
yeah.
It's somehow the key point.
It's one of the key points, but I'll summarize it later.
The naive person, the person who never heard of polymer quantization or more, what if they would just use the 1 over x itself.
Exactly.
Just as such.
Exactly.
And this amounts to replacing the 1 over x with some other function.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, let me just go back and say one more thing about that. So essentially, if you're just a computational physicist, you would say, okay, I can represent 1 over x, but now I have to exclude that one lattice point because I can't compute there. So what this is saying is, well, there's another way to do this. And the other way to do this is just to realize that the function you want to put on the lattice can be rewritten using the derivative of some other function.
Yeah, or you could shift the lattice.
The other way to do this is to exclude that point. So there are two ways to proceed if you have a singular potential, is to get rid of the singular point by hand, or leave the singular point in, and use a different scheme for finite difference.
Yeah,
and so
I think it's the same thing, excluding by hand. You could just shift the lattice so it was on half.
So if you do that, you're still using the same function.
You're still using the same function.
You're saying you're just not going to compute it. Are you going to compute it at x equals plus epsilon and x equals minus epsilon? But that's all you're going to do. So this is something different from that.
Can't you just have your lattice being minus a half? Plus a half, plus 3 half.
Yes, that's right.
So it just doesn't include the zero.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, so that would be, so you get another way.
I mean, it's a regular lattice.
It's a regular lattice, but what you're saying is that for computational convenience, you're going to exclude the point 1 over x. So if you actually plot the lattice function, it's going to look exactly like the Coulomb function. But this way of doing it is actually a different function.
Yes.
Yeah. So all I'm pointing out here is that there is a finite difference scheme which could have been used earlier for potentials like this, which is just this. And it's immediately evident because the Poisson bracket is doing exactly this for you, this derivative with respect to root x. Okay, so coming to the model that people have been looking at, is basically just FRW. I've written it in ADM variables, suitably reduced. We have a phase space consisting of a configuration space, scale factor, and scalar field, and their conjugate momentum. And the Hamiltonian constraint is the only one, and that's what it looks like up there. Now, if you take a regular or irregular lattice, it doesn't matter. The essential contribution to quantum corrections near the Big Bang would come again from writing these one over eight factors using shift operators. And so it's immediate if you're starting from the point of view that you have a Wheeler-DeWitt equation you don't know how to solve, you're going to solve it on a lattice. But the Wheeler-DeWitt limit for large A is immediate, which is which in fact is just the equation that you've discretized to get the finite difference equation. And for small a, you want to take the point of view that the lattice is fundamental, so you don't really want to take a continuum limit there. So let me just summarize. I could have said much more, I realize. The main point about this is that the spectra for anti-symmetric case converge to standard quantum mechanics as lambda goes to zero, but the spectra for the symmetric case depends strongly on lambda, even though you have a singularity that's regulated. So what this says is that the singularity avoidance involves more input than just writing 1 over x in some convenient way. Mechanism of singularity resolution is then ultimately more or less the same, which is a boundary condition on the wave function and not some new type of quantization, at least as far as this particular problem is concerned. And the other last remark is every finite difference approximation, in fact, is a polymer quantization. The converse also holds, but you can have polymer quantizations with irregular lattices, and then it's just harder to compute with. But it's a one-to-one match. So basically, computational physicists have been doing this for years, and they just think of it as an approximation. But the conceptual difference, of course, is something I've already mentioned. The conceptual difference is that the lambda in polymer quantum mechanics is viewed as fundamental discreteness scale rather than a computational aid. And of course, the same is true for all polymer approaches to quantum gravity, whether you're using AVM variables or loop variables. So I'll stop there and basically leave with one question. The kind of things that I don't know how to do at the moment with just taking AVM constraints and putting them on a lattice is, can you get things like discreteness of area and volume? I suspect you can. The difference between discreteness of area and volume is that they come from the diagonal operators, not from the shift operators. And the inverse scale factor is constructed using the shift operators. So it could be that LQG with the area and volume is giving something which is actually different from the standard discretizations, taking Wheeler-DeWitt equations and putting them on a lattice. But I'm not sure yet because I haven't looked at it sufficiently closely. So I'll just stop there.
How would the finite difference physicists the approximation work in the symmetric case? You know, the person who uses the naive, say, exclusion of zero or whatever.
It wouldn't make any, let's see. So,
because you said this essentially worked well in the anti-symmetric case.
It
didn't work well.
Yeah, so there's actually an exact analog of this. Lambda corresponds in the symmetric case it turns out that there's a work by Fuster on exactly the hydrogen spectrum for the symmetric case and the anti-symmetric case. He studies the radial equation in detail, and he imposes a cutoff by hand. And he has sort of a length scale cutoff where he takes the Coulomb potential and just makes it flat at the bottom. And so he's got some length scale L where that happens. So this lambda is related to his L, and he finds that the ground state wave function analytically also diverges. So we're finding the same result, actually.
So you're saying that if I find a difference approximation, you get the wrong answer?
I didn't say I would get the wrong answer. I simply said that the energy eigenvalues depend on lambda.
Yeah, but that is the wrong answer. I mean, if you were doing just a finite difference approximation to the true
we're looking at the problem on a line,
right?
And this is different from saying we're in three dimensions and looking at the.
So in
the ground state in the case of the problem on a line, there's again agreement with the continuum case. So it's not that our method or the inverse scale factor is not working. It's still working, but it does correspond in that case also to the result that one gets in the continuous case.
Maybe it's not even essentially self-adjoint in the case. I would kind of guess that would be...
In the symmetric case, yes, I think so.
So that there's no well, there is no well-defined answer to the ground state.
For the symmetric case. Yes. Well, there's in Fischer's result.
Well, the symmetric case is just part of the sector. I mean, there's just one Hamiltonian.
Right. So in the symmetric case, the ground state diverges, but the first excited state is supposed to converge to some value, and we couldn't see that numerically.
So we have
yes.
Actually work for the subpoint. So you could do the limit number equal to zero.
For the case of the
anti-symmetric. For the anti-symmetric, and it wasn't really diverging.
No, it wasn't. It was converging to the.
And I forgot how it works. You see, I think things called diverge because they never want to take the.
Oh, they're computing something different, though. They're so here we're just computing the energy eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. And in their case, they actually don't want to take lambda.
Yeah, they don't want to.
They don't want to.
There are sometimes long discussions with them.
Oh, I see.
And I don't know whether things diverge then.
Okay, so what I know about that is one other comment related to this, which I didn't get a chance to write up, is I don't know if you're referring to this, the Green Unruh objection to this constraint, or you're not.
It's just there might be one fundamental difference in the system. You look at and look for cosmology is about it. Cosmology is not really defined for lambda equal to zero.
Yeah, I mean, they actually don't want to take lambda equals zero. They want to say, well, once we meet the fundamental discreteness scale, this is the fundamental theory. And the only thing we're interested in is that if one is looking at scales much larger, large A, that we get the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And so. So what this is saying about that is it depends on what you're computing. So perhaps there's things you can compute there which would have a well-defined limit as lambda goes to zero, but I don't know what those things are. Mm-hmm. Here is a very specific thing where the lambda equals zero limit exists, namely the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian with the anti-symmetric boundary conditions. Yeah.
I mean, it's basically because it's an important problem, because no one really knows what kind of lambda value you take in the form of
I see. Okay. The only other comment I have, it's not directly related to your question. Firstly, I don't know. I mean, it would depend on what one is computing.
Mm-hmm.
I think if they're just doing scattering, then they're not. They certainly don't want to take lambda equals zero. Otherwise, their scattering will look like. The singularity is not avoided as soon as lambda goes to zero. So that becomes qualitatively different. The other comment about this is that the initial Hamiltonian constraints that were written down for the same Hamiltonian constraint that I wrote, the LQG versions of the Hamiltonian constraint operator were such that there was a problem with the evolution. So if one said, right, I'm just going to solve the differential equation h psi equals zero and ask what are the solutions for some states expanded in a basis, just like I did here, what Unruh and Green found is that the solutions are such that they're well-behaved and then they diverge to plus infinity or minus infinity after a few evolution steps. So what that indicated is that the Hamiltonian constraint H acting on psi was actually something which was not a stable system for positive cosmological constant. Now, it turns out that if you look at that Hamiltonian constraint, and we'll just look at it as a difference equation, it's actually von Neumann unstable. There's a von Neumann criteria of instability which goes back 60 years. So that was the problem with that finite differencing from the point of view of a computational physicist. Then this was corrected later on in a different version of a Hamiltonian constraint for positive cosmological constant, where the lattice spacing was taken to be position dependent. In other words, it was not a fixed lattice spacing, but the lattice spacing depended on position. So that's like saying in your shift operator, you don't write e to the I lambda p, you write e to the I lambda of x p, where that lambda of x function is picked for you in a specific way. So what they do then is they get a different Hamiltonian constraint with this different shift operator, where the shift operator is again always entering in the 1 over a pieces. And then they find that it's no longer fundamentally unstable, of course, they don't use that terminology because it, I don't think they're thinking like a computational physicist.
What is fundamental?
Okay, so fundamental stability says if you take some sort of differential equation and put it on a computer, you have a delta t spacing and a delta x spacing. And if your delta t and delta x are such that they do not mesh naturally with the scales in your original problem, suppose you're doing a wave equation, if you have a delta t and delta x, you have a lattice speed, which is just delta x over delta t. If that speed is larger than the actual velocity in your wave equation, then you'll evolve for a little bit numerically, and then your code will just blow up.
I think this might actually involve Courant.
Yeah, it's almost like a definition of
Not an idea, but I don't know if I
heard. So, okay, I just know the term von Neumann, because what he does is he simply says, take a finite difference equation, put in a mode ansatz for this, basically an amplitude and a phase, and ask what happens to your amplitude after
right, so
a couple of iterations.
Right, so that would be a more general criteria.
And that's
the particular thing that depends on the velocity of...
Ah, okay, so the so the velocity thing is actually... Yeah, I mean, that's that, so it coincides for that case, it coincides with fundamental stability. But basically, the general thing is take any finite difference equation, put in an amplitude and a phase, plug it in, and ask what happens, what's the magnitude of your amplitude, what it happens to it when you finite difference evolve.
Linearizing it.
Hmm?
If it's linear. If something is linear, are you linearizing?
No, you don't need to linearize. You're simply making a mode ansatz for your finite difference equation and asking, how does your amplitude grow? Your magnitude of your amplitude is a function of your lattice spacing. And if magnitude of your amplitude is bounded, then you have a stable finite difference scheme. Otherwise, you don't have a stable finite difference scheme. And that's basically the fundamental.
You said you would diagnose it even for a general function in terms of just plane waves, even if it's not linear. Is that what you're saying?
Let's see. So I know it's used. It might. I know it's used for linear differential equations.
Yes,
yes. I don't know how effective it is for nonlinear differential equations. But I think that in that case, it would be linearization stability that one would be checking,
yeah.
not arbitrary high orders. Yes. So, yeah. So essentially, the bottom line from our work is that if I want to make a controversial statement, the controversial statement would be, take your favorite classical theory, put it on a lattice, call it fundamental, and you have a quantum gravity model.
Okay.